I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
It's been another couple of weeks of we've never seen anything like this before in politics, local and national. A new book and an anonymous White House official describe President Trump as off the rails, even as he blasts his own attorney general for the indictments of two of his supporters in Congress. More progressives around the country join Georgia Democratic gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams in reshaping the national party. And federal investigators demand travel and expense reports for former Atlanta Mayor Kasim Reed in his entire time in office. So much for that quiet end of the summer news cycle. So fortify yourself with a healthy political breakfast, and we've got a place for you. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Joining us again, Brian Robinson, a Republican strategist and former deputy chief of staff for Governor Nathan Deal, and Democratic strategist Theron Johnson. He's a former National Southern Regional Director for the Obama 2012 campaign. Guys, welcome back.
Great to be back. Good to be here, Dennis.
All right, let's start with the dizzying series of events of the last couple of weeks in Washington, D.C. And Brian, I'll start with you, especially with the New York Times op-ed in which the senior administration official took the president to task and basically said there's a group in the White House trying to save him for himself. When you see this, not from folks who some Republicans call the deep state, but somebody who the president brought with him to Washington, what kind of position does that put Republicans, particularly those in these congressional races that we have here in Georgia, as they head into these elections where President Trump is an issue?
We don't know if this is somebody that the president brought with him. It's a nebulous senior administration official title, so we don't really know who this is exactly. But I will say this. You did not see the New York Times and the Washington Post or any other major national publication publishing anonymous op-eds about President Obama and any dysfunction or unethical behavior.
Well, as far as we know, there weren't any.
But they would never publish something like that. And you look at this stuff in the Bob Woodward book that we're looking at this week, too. It is from people who aren't named in the book. I mean, there are people named, but they're being quoted by a third anonymous party. And I agree with the president. It's an unfair standard. You can't constantly be responding to anonymous quotes because people who are speaking anonymously are driving their own agendas. They have personal, selfish reasons for doing the leaking. So it's an impossible position for the president to be in. Now, on your question, how does this impact Georgia people on the ballot? Well, if you're running for federal office, there are only two races in this state that are competitive. And this is
the sixth district and the seventh district.
And so you may get some media attention on that. You may need to think strategically through what your message is going to be if you're Republican Rob Woodall or Republican Karen Handel running against Democratic challengers. And you have to thread this needle of if what is being said is true by legitimate sources, distancing yourself from it, while at the same time expressing sympathy for the president's viewpoint. This is a completely unfair standard. And they're right. It's a completely ridiculous, unfair standard to which no one else has ever held in history.
There was even talk, though, according to the op-ed, among members of the administration early on about invoking the 25th Amendment. And it gets a little complicated, but basically the 25th Amendment allows members of the cabinet and the vice president to say, we don't think the president is fit. It also gives the president a chance to fight back, and Congress gets involved. So if that is in the ether now, at least as a hypothetical that could happen, are those, particularly those two incumbents that you mentioned, Rob Woodall and Karen Handel, going to have to answer questions about that?
I think it's legitimate to ask them about the role of Congress and where they would be based on their observations thus far of the Trump administration. But look, I haven't seen in the Trump administration anything that is out of line, out of character from what he ran on and how he behaved in 2016 on the campaign trail when Americans elected him president. Americans bought a product, and the product is exactly as it was advertised. So this idea that the people that he brought in were surprised or amazed by how he performed in the Oval Office, to me, just doesn't hold water.
So the interesting thing about this is that this op-ed, and I agree with Brian, that this definitely is something different when it comes to journalism. In the history of our country, we have not seen publications like the New York Times or the Washington Post or any major publication release an anonymous op-ed like this. But here's the problem, Dennis. This president, in his behavior and his conduct, makes it believable. And that's why they can go out and make this anonymous claim. And we're all talking about it. We're all reading it because whether it's true or not, whether it's a senior official who actually worked in the White House, who is working in the White House, mm-hmm. or maybe has an official role in this administration, everything that was in an op-ed, because of the president's behavior and how he's acted while he was a candidate for president and while he's been president, makes it so believable.
But do the Democrats see it as being worth it to go there in their campaigns for the 6th, the 7th, and the governor's race?
Well, the one thing is—
because Brian Kemp was endorsed by President Trump.
Absolutely. And so it's a delicate balance. So you have to remind people that you have a very unpopular president that right now, even in the state of Georgia, who has a less than 50% approval rating. But he has this unique ability through some of his very unhinged and racist rants to really fire up a base of voters that turn out for
the
Republicans.
And the vice president is coming to town to campaign for Brian Kemp. So Democrats have to be a little bit careful if they're trying to win some of those voters in
right.
a close gubernatorial
right.
race.
Right. So Mike Pence has been the person that they send in who's a more appealing person to correlate the base of Republicans in Georgia. However, I do think that nationally in Georgia and Florida and other places, particularly in these congressional races that we have going on here in Georgia, I do think the balance is remind people how bad Trump is, but also have a Georgia-specific message of how you're going to talk about the issues that benefit the Georgians most. I just think that back to this op-ed, it's been people like Omarosa. We've also heard Steve Bannon, who's left the administration, mm-hmm. who said very similar, if not identical, things that this op-ed said about Trump and his administration. People are afraid. People are afraid to say anything about this president. Even when you see Vice President Mike Pence coming out and immediately saying, hey, I didn't write it, you're going to see a lot of other officials coming out and saying, hey, I had nothing to do with this. Because this dictator that we have in the White House and President Trump has made people so afraid. And I do believe, I applaud those members of his staff that are trying to actually stop this disruptive behavior and really save Donald Trump from himself.
Brian, it seems like forever ago, but it was just recently that the nation paid its respects to Senator McCain. And Johnny Isaacson came out with a statement where he departed from what is often his usual very diplomatic stand and said, anybody who says bad things about John McCain deserves a whipping. And then he kind of went into his own confessional a little bit. This is unusual for Senator Isaacson. What do you think brought that on?
He was in his office and he was watching television and he saw news reports about the White House bringing the flag down on that Monday, shortly after McCain had died. He felt like that was not a sufficient amount of time for the flag to be up, and he was angry when he went to the floor, from what I am told, and got down there, and boy, you really saw it come out. And it's notable, and we're talking about it and newsworthy because you're right. This is not the Johnny Isaacson that we know and that we've come to expect, who is measured, who goes way out of his way to render judgment on the president and has done that throughout the last 4 years that since the president was a candidate and then in the White House. It was very strongly worded. You could see the passion, the emotion. You could see that this is somebody who held John McCain in immense esteem, as do I. I'm a huge John McCain fan. I do support those who got caught, to paraphrase the president. I think John McCain is an American hero. No matter what he did in office, he is an American hero because he refused to be released out of order by the Vietnamese communists because of his connections to his father. He stayed there and took torture for years more, and we should have statues to him all over this country because of it.
Does that mean, though, that we'll see Senator Isaacson take on the president more when it comes to other things, going back to the op-ed, for instance, or when it comes to the president's attacks on Jeff Sessions over the indictments of two congressmen who were initial supporters of President Trump. Will there be pressure on Georgia lawmakers to draw a line with the president when it comes to perhaps intervening in cases brought by the Justice Department?
In the last 50 years, there has been a total of 3 criminal indictments and 1 criminal conviction for Democrats in the executive branch. In that same time period, there have been 120 criminal indictments and 89 convictions of Republicans in the executive branch. The only question now is how many more people will actually be indicted and possibly be convicted under this Trump administration? This attack from Trump on his attorney general, who, by the way, was the first U.S. senator to come out and endorse his campaign, has gone on this all-out assault and attack on your attorney general. And so this, to me, shows that this president continues to be unhinged and he cannot govern. So with that being said, it also sends a very unfortunate precedent to our leaders in federal government and the FBI and Department of Justice that if you do your job and you convict criminals, people who have committed criminal acts, then the president will rebel against you. He will reprimand you. He will attack you. And so I think that, again, it's a problem for people all across the country, especially establishment Republicans who are in midterm election battles.
We should quickly point out here that these two congressmen have not been convicted, but they have been indicted.
And if you read the charges against the congressman, they are fairly damning. I think the New York congressman who is accused of insider
Chris
trading,
Collins, I think.
Chris Collins, the evidence on it, whether he is convicted or not, the evidence is eyebrow-raising and concerning. And if it's not insider trading, then I don't know what is. I think that this is a horrifically bad move strategically for the president. There is nobody on the Republican side defending it, nobody, which is – tells you a lot. There's no chorus coming out saying, yeah, he should be attacking Jeff Sessions. We're going to lose those 2 seats. And because
but
if they committed a crime, they need
enough
to go. People do speak out. It's not every day. They're not going to like put out releases. But if asked, you are hearing Republicans say that's not appropriate. He shouldn't be doing that. But I think strategically, it's also really bad for him given the larger context, which is that he is possibly facing charges for obstruction of justice. And this looks like someone who's not concerned about obstruction of justice. So it's sending the wrong signal at the wrong time. I wish he would stop talking about Jeff Sessions. If you're going to fire him. It's not a good idea to do it. Just quit talking about it, though.
From the White House to the race for governor, where the president is definitely a factor, Theron, I'll start with you. There's a new poll out from Channel 2 Action News and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. The UGA School of Public and International Affairs conducted it for the media outlets, and it shows a statistical dead heat in the race for governor right now, 44.9% for Stacey Abrams, 45.3% for Brian Kemp, a tiny edge for Kemp, but within the margin of error.
This is huge for the Abrams campaign. To have a Republican red state like Georgia in the month of September with less than 60 days to go before the general election happens, to have her in a dead heat with a Republican nominee is a big boost for her campaign. This shows that there is a viable pathway for a Democrat to win in Georgia.
I recall, though, 4 years ago, and I remember this because I was watching this, the polls showed Jason Carter, the Democratic nominee, very close to, and in some cases even slightly ahead of, the incumbent governor, Nathan Deal, Brian's old boss, and look what happened. I mean, Governor Deal, I think, finished in the mid-50s.
Dennis, that's why we love you so much, because you keep us honest, and I knew you were going to bring that up. 2 differences, though. 1, you were running against a very popular incumbent governor at the time, who we knew that had the unique ability, because of his record in his first term, to coalesce and consolidate the Republican base. The difference also is that you could really dictate the electorate because you didn't have the infrequent and sporadic voters that you're going to see in this race. One common thread that we've seen nationally, and it was in a Kemp's race against Kasich Cagle, and it was also in a Stacey Abrams and Stacey Evans race, and we even just seen it in Florida. where you cannot poll, where you cannot sort of have an analytical strategy to deal with, is the level of anger and enthusiasm from the left and also from the right. I think this poll shows, number one, that there's not really a lot of undecided voters out there. Right now, you know,
7.6%, which is unusually low at this point.
So the challenge for the Abrams campaign and a challenge for Democrats, because I know Brian is going to say this, is that how do you make up the ground in the middle? We know that there's about 300,000 voters that have consistently voted with Republicans since 2002 in the state, and the Republicans have done a really good job of winning the battle in the middle. So now we see that both candidates have motivated their base. Now, who can get the undecideds, and who are they, and how do you get them to vote for you?
That was such remarkably good spin. I mean, really good. I mean, and look at what he did there. Not only did he put out the Democratic talking points and the Democratic view very ably, he also put me in the corner by saying it's different because Nathan Deal is so great. You know, how can I respond to that when I was part of that campaign, part of both of his campaigns? But I'll speak from the experience that I bring from those two campaigns. We faced similar numbers in 2010 and in 2014, as did Senator Perdue on 2014 when he was on the ballot with Governor Deal. It showed Michelle Nunn and Jason Carter sometimes ahead, and then going into the weekend before the election even, the headlines in local media were, election appears headed to runoff. And I was screaming my head off because I knew good and well we were going to win by 7. And even on election night, I remember we had the 2014 election night party at the College Football Hall of Fame, and I was going around doing the pre-6 p.m. TV news interviews saying we're going to win by 7. And they were looking at me with pity because they thought I was just such a naive Pollyanna. And guess what? We won by 7. And it's all on the record, on tape, that I said it before the polls even closed. So we see this every year. For whatever reason, there's this Democratic advantage in these polls that's not there in reality. We've heard Theran and his partisan colleagues talk for years about these phantom Democratic voters who are out there who didn't show up for Obama. You know, I do not believe that there is this large cachet of Democratic votes that sat at home when Obama was on the ballot. Now, I agree, but where Theran is totally right, and this is a huge advantage, and this is going to be what makes or breaks it, is he's totally right that the Democrats have fire and fury and anger, and they are so
to coin a phrase, fire and fury.
Fire and fury. they are ready to storm the battlements. And Republicans aren't there. I mean, they like what Donald Trump is doing. They are supportive of his agenda. But we are not motivated. We are not energized, and the Dems are. And we're already seeing it in some local races in Georgia.
Here's the mystery, and I mean, you guys know things so well. I'll see if you can unravel this one. The poll shows that President Trump's approval rating among Republicans is 85.2%. No surprise there. You know, you've got a lot of national polls showing the same thing. Yet, 46% of Republicans, only 46%, say they're more likely to embrace a Trump-connected candidate. That is a big gap between approval of the president and embracing a candidate that he endorsed, such as Brian Kemp.
Well, we saw, Dennis, literally about 2 months ago that 90% of Georgia Republicans supported the president. Mm-hmm. We've now seen a 10% decline. The one thing that I'm very happy that Brian admitted this is that you have this unpopular president who has this unique ability to motivate a base of voters in the Republican Party that Brian Kemp is going to need. I'm not in the Brian Kemp campaign. I know Brian, you know, maybe communicates with those folks a little bit more than me. But I would bet you that the conversation they're trying to have right now and looking at these new polling numbers is how do we stay with the president on policy issues at a time when we know that his approval rating is only 40% in the state of Georgia. But then do we go back to what we saw from a Casey Cagle, Nathan Deal, even Senator Perdue, which was more of a compassionate, conservative, pro-business type Republican who didn't fire up Democrats the way that Donald Trump has done. And also, I think you see this enormous amount of pivot to the middle from the Kemp campaign, even with some of his advertisements and also his sort of renewed and sort of revised passion to sort of walk back some of his support of RFRA in his state.
The Religious Freedom Bill.
Yeah, that he understands that this is something that the business community is very concerned about.
The fact that this is this tight, I think it's probably accurate at this moment. I do think the fundamentals still favor Brian Kemp. Now, because of demographic change in Georgia, that Republican built-in majority goes down a little bit every day. I mean, literally hundreds of people move here every day, and that advantage goes down. And Brian Kemp, to his credit, knows this is going to be tight. They're not expecting to win by eight. I think if they are, they need to get out of politics and go do something else for a living because they don't get it. They do get it. They know this is going to be competitive, and you're seeing strategic changes. He's got to change how he is viewed from the primary, where he ran a very cultural, tribal appeal to Republican primary voters, had the Trump endorsement there. And the Trump endorsement was huge in Brian Kemp's landslide. It was a maker.
You of all people, would know that.
Yeah. I mean, I was one of the ones who got the knife in the back for that.
you were a consultant for Casey's
case. I have the scars.
Yeah, the stitched up scars.
And, my wife used to work for Sonny Perdue, so I, of course, sent her the story this week about Sonny being the reason. I'm like, well, you know. If
Shocker. We were all shocked by that in Georgia. You know?
Who knew? We just thought Donald Trump was watching Georgia TV and liked the ads, right?
Yeah. In other words, President Trump saying that Sonny Perdue, his agriculture secretary, was the reason, the man who convinced him to weigh in on behalf of Brian Kemp.
Yeah. So Brian Kemp has a built-in advantage. And here's what this race is going to come down to is two things stand out to me in the poll numbers that we're looking at. One is that while Trump does have an 85% approval rating with Republicans, which is why his endorsement meant so much in the primary, he is a bit underwater with the general election electorate, almost by 10 points. His approval is in the 40s. His disapproval is in the low 50s. So you're seeing about a 10-point spread there. And so that's part of the headwinds that Brian Kemp is going to face. Does the Trump endorsement make him stronger headwinds? No, because he was going to face them regardless because he's got an R behind his name in this environment and it's very tribal. I think having Pence come in and do events is going to be a net positive. But you're not going to see Trump here because he is a net negative in the polling, and the White House knows it.
94% of the Democrats who were polled, Dennis, disapprove of the president. So Brian Kemp now faces the similar problem that Roy Barnes faced when he was running against you guys in 2010, is that, you know, you had a president, President Obama, who in his first 2 years got off to a good start, but they were going through a very controversial conversation about affordable
healthcare.
So now Brian Kemp has this president who is got this disapproval in Georgia with the majority of the electorate, especially Democrats, but also can fire up the base that he's going to need to turn out in November. So this is going to get interesting. I think, again.
Excellent, by the way. Excellent historical reference there, because I can't disagree with you at all. That's absolutely, you're absolutely right.
Here's a question about outside forces, because we've talked a lot even here about Vice President Pence, for instance, coming in to talk on behalf of Brian Kemp. Stacey Abrams, Theron, was able to generate a lot of any attention in the South, any attention nationally that was directed in the South from progressives and progressive campaign donors was zeroed in on Stacey Abrams. Now, all of a sudden, next door in Florida, you have Andrew Gillum staging a huge upset in the Democratic primary for governor. He's taking on Ron DeSantis, the Republican congressman. So the question becomes, okay, progressives who were looking at Stacey Abrams alone in the South now have, do they have to divide their energy, their support, their loyalty in bringing that outside money, whereas more of it would have gone to Stacey Abrams had not Andrew Gillum pulled off what he did in Florida?
So I definitely think that the level of enthusiasm and the national profile that Stacey Abrams was able to garner definitely helped the Gillum race, because Andrew Gillum, who I know personally, who's a friend, who's a great mayor of Tallahassee, was always able to say, hey, guys, look at what happened in Georgia. Mm-hmm. If we motivate these infrequent, sporadic voters, get them to come out in Democratic primary, and we don't do anything to alienate moderate white Democrats who vote in a primary, we can win this. I definitely think that there's going to be enough money to go around to support both candidates, because if you look at the limits in Florida, they're a little bit more loose than they are in Georgia. I mean, there's an enormous amount of unlimited money that they can give to PACs. And I think that in Georgia, the limit for governor is a little larger than it is for other races. And so I don't think either candidate is going to have a money problem. I think that you see all the environmental groups, all of the social justice groups, all these big donors have already given money to both of them. I think the big question is going to be, how do they spend it at a time when we also know that that money is going to be matched by a lot of Republican dollars that are going to come into the state as well?
You know, it's the swamp, and the Democrats have all the money. It's what I call liberal privilege.
Now, this swamp, is this the same swamp that your president was supposed to go to Washington to drain?
Give me time. You know, it's terminating up. And Gillum, the Democratic candidate in Florida, of course, is under investigation for corruption there at Tallahassee City Hall, just like we have here in Atlanta City Hall.
And so, just like we have in the White House.
And if I were Jeff Sessions, I'd perhaps go open up an investigation and rigorously pursue it to make the president happy, to kind of outweigh his madness about the congressmen who are under investigation. And I'm not saying do it for political purposes, but there looks to be something there that needs to be investigated, which is legit. Democrats are going to pour in money just like they did for John Ossoff in the 6th Congressional District. I think Republicans privately are preparing for us to be outspent 2-1 in the governor's race, which is unprecedented. Stacey Abrams has more than 40,000 individual donors. Now, some of those people gave $5. Some gave $6,000, but some gave $5. By comparison, Nathan Deal, in his reelection, with the power of incumbency, had a little over 6,000 individual donors. That should make your jaw hit the floor if you are a Republican. Just see the energy and the commitment and the widespread interest in this race. I mean, the New York Times keeps writing about the Georgia governor's race. I mean, it's really remarkable the national focus that's being put on this. Let's see if Stacey Abrams can rise to the occasion and really seize this platform she's been given. And here's the thing in the poll, and Theron, I think, is going to agree with me on this, that I think I need to see is where in the governor's race, because this is going to matter down ballot tremendously, are college-educated white women in the metro Atlanta area falling? Because if there is an advantage for Stacey Abrams among that group, and they are a reliable voting group, much like black women are, they're super voters.
Yeah, they tend to turn out.
And they have voted for Nathan Deal and Johnny Idenson and David Perdue in the past. And if they're going to show up and vote against Karen Handel and against Rob Woodall and against Brian Kemp, we've got a serious problem. So I want to see what's happening there. If Kemp can hold those voters, Republicans are going to have a good night.
I totally agree with Brian. I am definitely looking at where are the suburban, college-educated, moderate, disaffected Republican women falling in this race. But the other thing that I'm going to pay very close attention to is that what was the sample of African-Americans in this poll?
And where
was it broken down in the metro area versus the rural areas?
Yep.
It's no secret. The Abrams campaign and all of the people on the ticket for Democrats, they've got to have a Obama plus like turnout in Georgia to match the sort of wave that we're anticipating to come from some of these Trump, you know, infrequent, sporadic voters on the right.
Along Theron's point about the number of African-Americans, the percentage of African-Americans polled in this survey, one of the reasons why Nathan Deal and David Perdue were appearing in tight races in 2014 was an oversampling of African Americans. And it was floating the Democratic numbers above the reality. So
you mean they talked to real people, but those people didn't turn out in what was anticipated.
No. They're talking to real people, but the percentage of African Americans in the poll was higher than the percentage of African Americans who voted on Election Day in that election.
Right.
So that's the difference. And so the poll had a Democratic bias in it because of the extra number of African Americans that didn't reflect electoral reality. And if that's what this is, again, we're seeing the exact same thing. And not for the first time, not for the second time. This happens every cycle. And I have this argument every cycle. And maybe this is the time when I'm wrong and the Democrats do turn out these phantom Democrat voters that Theron's been talking about for years. Maybe this is. But year after year, I've been proven right by saying it's not above 30. 30% is a magic number for African American turnout. If it gets up above that, Democrats can win. If it gets below it, they can't.
But the difference is, and Brian, I give you credit, you have been saying that for probably the last 8 years.
Yes, I have.
But the difference here is this. I think you will agree. What you and I have just experienced by, you know, being involved in politics in Georgia and also watching races closely across the country is that the difference is that these infrequent and sporadic voters are coming out and you can't poll them. They don't show up in polling. They don't even really show up in the campaign sort of tracker because you can't track them. They are sitting there. They're irate. They're mad. And they're on the Republican side and Democratic side. The other thing is that I do think that the Abrams campaign has spent a significant amount of resources and time registering these voters. Mm-hmm. Now, Brian is going to say, that's great. That's wonderful. He's probably, you know, want Jeff Sessions to launch an investigation into that, too. But but the one thing that I think that he will agree is that if you do something long enough and if you learn from your mistakes and if she's able to generate 3, 5, 7% more turnout of African-Americans, it may be the difference.
We will take a quick break and then back with more Political Breakfast. Stay right here.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Support for WABE's local coverage on maternal health and mortality comes from Georgia Health Initiative, whose mission is to inspire and promote collective action that advances health equity for all Georgians. Learn more at GeorgiaHealthInitiative.org.
Turning to City Hall. Theron, I'm going to start with you. Mm-hmm. Two things happened. Of course, there was the demand from federal investigators for the expense records of Mayor Kasim Reed going through his entire term of office. At the same time, we saw Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms suddenly being everywhere, announcing Atlanta's Checkbook, a new program to increase transparency so people could see where things like expenses were going. She created the new position, actually bring back the old position of Public Safety Commissioner. She presided over the demolition of blighted housing. She announced the end of the contract between the city and ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Are these two things related?
No, because I think what you're seeing is that, and I went back and looked at this, if you look at every mayor that we've had since Maynard Jackson, Labor Day is usually the time that they're able to get their teams together. They have a, you know, cabinet. They have their folks together, and they really start to taking some new sort of bold steps that they campaigned on. Look, Mayor Bottoms talked a lot about during the campaign mm-hmm. that she would go in and she would first thing that she would do besides dealing with affordability and equity in this city is that she would basically make sure that she had the public trust. So this chief transparency officer is something that she talked about during the campaign. I'm going to even be a fair analyst here, is that this whole conversation about an open checkbook, about opening up the finances of city government, actually was talked about 4 years ago. There's been a lot of conversations in committees about doing it, but here's the difference. You got a lot of people who propose things, and then you got people who actually do things. This mayor actually got it done. Let's just talk about what she's just done, Dennis. She has opened up the entire city government for the last year and then 2017 and 2018, where Brian, when he's got some downtime and he's sitting outside on his porch and watching the dogs, and if he's just doing commercial break, wants to go and say, you know, let me type in a name on this new wonderful site and see if they've had any city business or they got any contracts or have been any payments to them. He can do that.
I Google Theron Johnson airport contract every day just to keep it, just to keep it.
And you will find zero. But then the last thing is that with the new sort of announcement, but of an old position of bringing in a new public safety commissioner to come in and basically help deal with a smart way to deal with crime in the city of Atlanta is leadership. The other thing is that, Dennis, is that she has been cooperating for the last 7 months with this ongoing federal investigation. The reason the federal government reopened these subpoenas which they had already sort of announced that they had were going to do, they announced it again, is because now you have an administration that says, look, we're going to cooperate with this investigation. We hope that it will end soon. And so now you see that sort of going on.
Don't think she's trying to say, look, I'm not paralyzed by the time that our administration would be taking to respond, to cooperate with the investigation. We are doing other things, too.
Yeah, and I think that it just was right around the time when the federal government wanted to go hire, I think, what, 6 new people to investigate the corruption in City Hall. And so I think that she's got to carry this momentum all the way through the end of the year, and I think that she's definitely on the right track.
Open checkbook. Isn't that what we had for the last 8 years?
Well, it depends on if you look at word open figuratively or literally. I think in this case, it's more on the side of transparency and letting the public know how their government is being run for them.
I think it's an open checkbook when you're like passing out taxpayer dollars at a holiday party based on who has the ugliest sweater. You know, that's an open checkbook.
The Atlanta Falcons and the Philadelphia Eagles got together in Philadelphia amid the question of what about players kneeling during the national anthem, Nike launching its Colin Kaepernick campaign. Let's bring it down to the Falcons and Arthur Blank, the owner. Now, he has tried to thread the needle on this one, not Colin Kaepernick ad specifically, but just telling the AJC recently he doesn't want to fine players who kneel, but he does want them to stand. He says this is a complex issue, and if players want to express themselves that way, they will. The NFL and the Players Association, in the view of a lot of analysts, should have figured this, and the owners, should have figured this out over the summer. And it makes it hard to do when, to be fair to Arthur Blank, when you say this is a complex issue.
Arthur Blank, more than anybody else in the country, has a needle to thread on this issue because he's the only NFL owner whose season ticket holder base is 48% African American. The second highest African American season ticket holder base is New Orleans, and it's 18%. I mean, isn't that startling? I mean, it's amazing how much wealth you have in the African American community here in Atlanta, and that's one of the reflections. So he's got to make sure that that base of customers is happy with what he's saying, that they feel like he understands their point of view and where they're coming from. But he's also got a lot of other customers who aren't going to stand by and continue supporting him if he comes out and is too much on the side of the players kneeling. And I think he's done a great job of trying to appease both of those bases. And not, because for me personally, I don't understand why Nike would wade into something like this and use inflammatory language like, even if it means sacrificing everything, when – you know, Republicans have responded, of course, with the Pat Tillerson.
Pat Tillerson.
Who, of course, was an Arizona Cardinal who quit the NFL to go serve his country and then died in action. That is sacrificing everything based on your beliefs, not losing your NFL contract.
All right. I'm going to try to be brief on this one because I'm very passionate about this. And so, you know, I'm so glad that Brian brought out that statistic and because I was actually going to mention that. You know, when you go to an Atlanta Falcons game, and even if you go to an Atlanta Hawks game, and now, you know, Braves Stadium, because, you know, my brothers and sisters, we feel we can drive to Cobb County and not get shot by a police officer or get pulled over because we're being profiled, going maybe almost outside 285. We're more, you know.
I'm glad you changed your view on that, because that's not where you were 3 years ago.
You know, because we're still very disappointed, disheartened that the Braves left Atlanta. But I want to applaud Nike. I think what Nike has done is show that they're a $70+ billion corporation that's bigger than just sports. To put Colin Kaepernick as the face of their Just Do It campaign, show America who we are. Like, because at the end of the day, I support our troops, I support our men and women in military, and I stand by our American flag. And I do truly believe that Colin Kaepernick, if he had said, I am kneeling, or he started by sitting, then he kneeled. I am sitting today because I feel that our veterans who go over and serve us and protect us every day, they come home and they don't get the adequate and appropriate services that they deserve when they come back and live with their families. If he had said that, I think you wouldn't have seen all this outrage. But because he said, I am doing this in a non-violent, peaceful way, expressing my First Amendment as a person, to say about all the police brutality and some of the social challenges that we were facing then and even we're facing now in our country, shows that he has sacrificed everything. Now, I want to be careful when I say this, and I agree with Brian. Pat Tillerson did leave the NFL, went and served his country, left it all on the field for us, and unfortunately died. And I'm not going to compare death to a person like Colin Kaepernick, who, by the way, has lost everything when it comes to his credibility, doing something that he has worked his whole life to be able to go to the NFL and be an NFL quarterback, who, by the way, almost won a Super Bowl. And so I think that he has been publicly tarnished. He has been probably the most criticized athlete and former athlete in the NFL. And so for Nike to take this bold step and show all of the different images, you got to really watch that clip closely, and to show that they're beyond sports and that they want to continue this conversation, I do think it puts pressure on owners like Arthur Blank in the NFL. But I want to applaud Arthur Blank because he has steadfast support for his players. I think he can continue to be for his players, be for his organization, and be for his fans. And I do think that the NFL is in a very tough position now, because when you go up against a $76 billion corporation and you want to respond to them, they have the means and the resources to have that conversation.
Outside of Atlanta, the NFL's base is hardy, working class to middle class, patriotic Americans, and they need to step carefully on offending them and showing them that they are different, have different values than middle America. It's
shouldn't
a very dangerous
they have
thing.
Worked this out, though, before
Absolutely.
Now?
Absolutely. Now, granted, I mean, I think a lot of it is the product here is the teams, and the teams are made up of individuals who aren't necessarily going to want to compromise, who want have a point they want to make. Here's my thing. As I said 2 weeks ago on this show, you don't have a right to keep your job if you express things that offend your employer. You do not have the right to do that. And that is something that the NFL owners have to make clear in a way that doesn't cause a backlash for them with the public.
But real quickly, and back to Colin Kaepernick, he is the one who had other NFL players follow his example who have knelt. Maybe there have been some sort of internal actions taken against them. But Colin Kaepernick, because perhaps he was the first, is the one who has not had a job, when it could be argued that even a couple of years later, he could certainly make some NFL rosters as a backup quarterback. It would be hard to argue that he is less skilled than some of the people who are on rosters now.
A judge just ruled that his lawsuit against the NFL, alleging that there was a huge collusion gathering amongst owners to cooperate with the NFL's request to not bring him back to the NFL, shows, Dennis, that this gentleman was singled out. He was blackballed. And again, for Nike to do it literally a few days before our beloved Atlanta Falcons traveled to Philadelphia to go up against the Super Bowl champs, the Philadelphia Eagles, there's some marketing and PR strategy here. But I agree with Brian. The NFL is to blame. I think they've got to take their share of blame in this, because the biggest mistake that they made, and if they could have hired Brian, I don't think they could have afforded him. You know, he's very expensive these days. But Brian would have told them that, why don't we bring in an NFL player and have this conversation? Let's not meet with our 32 white owners to talk about race and police brutality and how do we communicate with these players. If they had involved the players, if the players mm-hmm. felt that they were heard and that they were involved in a solution, I think you would have seen more players coming out saying, hey, guys, let's put this behind us and let's move forward.
I want to finish with this. This is one more piece of evidence of liberal privilege. Nike felt they could get away with doing something so inflammatory because it was from a leftist viewpoint. And that is what dominates the national media, the TV news, the print news, et cetera. And it is what dominates corporate values. And you're seeing that come out. They feel safe in doing it. They would never take such an inflammatory stand from a conservative viewpoint. Liberal privilege.
And that's it for this week's Political Breakfast. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Joining me today, Republican strategist Brian Robinson, a former deputy chief of staff for Governor Nathan Deal, and Democratic strategist Theron Johnson, a former national Southern regional director for the Obama 2012 campaign. Guys, it's been a pleasure. As always, thank you.
Go Dawgs.
Go Nike.
And if you like this show, subscribe, and you can do that wherever you get your podcasts, and be sure to rate us. It's a great way to make sure other people can find us. And we'll be back in your feed and in your head soon with more nourishing political conversation. Be sure to join us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Local, state, national politics. WABE and NPR have the coverage you need. I'm Jim Burris, host of WABE's All Things Considered. Whether it's on the air at 90.1, streaming online, or connecting through our mobile app, WABE keeps you on top of election 2024 in what's sure to be a pivotal year in politics. And for candidates and ballot information, visit our election hub at wabe.org/election2024.